Thank you, Sylvia, and thank you for the Peace and Justice Committee for inviting me to give this presentation. First question you have in your mind is, why the heck is a simple country astrophysicist talking to us about climate change? Well, it all started innocently enough, probably about a year and a half or so ago. One of my friends who runs a space science certificate program for pre-service teachers at Johns Hopkins University. As she had done previously, she asked me to come and talk about life cycles of stars and black holes and stuff like that, and so I did that. And lo and behold, who should be in this audience of pre-service teachers but Rosie Graff? And so Rosie kind of blabbed to her mother that she heard me give a talk on stars and stuff like that, and Ginny Graff happens to be one of the regional presidents or coordinators, I forget the exact title, of a organization of the American Federation of Ministers, I think is the name of the organization. And at the time, Ginny was organizing their national conference here in Northern Virginia. And so Ginny called me up and asked me if I would talk on climate change, because the theme for their conference was global sustainability. And I tried to explain to her that I was just a simple country astrophysicist. But she says, no, my daughter says you're a great speaker and that you have lots of passion and you would be wonderful talking to our group. And even when I tried to find her another speaker, she insisted. And so that's kind of how I got into this. And then one among you, who will remain nameless, suggested this to the Peace and Justice Committee, and so therefore I am here with great pleasure. Okay, so so the question still remains: How the heck did a simple country astrophysicist get to talking about climate change? Well, in my role as an education scientist at NASA, not only was I doing education work within the astrophysics division, but I was also getting to know the people who did education work in the other divisions in NASA, including earth science. And so I kind of got to know earth science specialists, and of course a big issue with them is climate change and the communication of climate change. And so I was privileged to hear a number of talks about these topics. And it's from that I drew, and sort of from my own interest in environmental issues, you know, that I drew these materials. So, now that you know a little bit about me, now I want to find out a little bit about you. There is something called... Hello. There we go. Okay. There is something called the Six Americas when it comes to views on climate change. And this is a representation of those six Americas, of essentially the six classifications of people. So there are the people who are alarmed, that is, they are highly certain of the human causes and threats to the globe. There are those that are concerned, they are fairly certain. There are the cautious. They are not so certain, and they are also unlikely to seek additional information on it. There are those who are disengaged. That is to say that they have other things to worry about and that climate change and global warming is the least of their concerns. There are the doubtful. The doubtful tend to, if they admit to climate change and global warming, insist that it is only natural causes. And then there are those who are dismissive, that those scientists, they're just making it up. So what I want you to do is I want you to turn to the person you're sitting next to and ask them, which of these categories do you think that you fall into? Okay. All right. Has everybody polled your neighbor? All right. Now, those of you who are sitting next to someone, remember, those of you who are sitting next to someone who is alarmed. Okay? Those of you sitting next to someone who is concerned. Okay, let's see. That's just about everybody, I think. And those of you who are sitting next to somebody who is neither of those two, but in some other category. Okay, now, here is the interesting thing about this. That is how America breaks down in terms of population and the percentage in each of those groups. So notice, if you add these up, that less than 50% are in the concerned and the alarmed. Less than 50% are in the concerned and the alarmed. The other interesting thing about this is when they've done this study is that these are not predictors of political leanings, gender, socioeconomic position, or age. So each of these cuts across politics, gender, age, socioeconomic position. All right? So this is kind of interesting, and later we can come back to the issue of, you know, if you were to communicate climate change, how do you communicate it to each of these groups? Because each of these groups may have a separate interest that you might want to address to them. All right, so here's what we're going to talk about. First of all, we will first assert that climate change is real. We will talk about, we'll take a slight detour to talk about the difference between weather versus climate. We will then talk about the evidence and the various effects of climate change. There are many. I'll just give a few examples. We'll talk about the reason for climate change. Essentially, it's heat-trapping gases, otherwise known as greenhouse gases. We will talk about the cause and exactly what we are doing to cause it. And then finally, it's what can we do about it? And this takes some interesting dimensions, especially when we talk about ourselves as people of faith. Okay, so first of all, climate change is real. But let's first make this distinction between climate versus weather. So this past year, Anchorage, while we were enjoying a balmy winter, Anchorage was getting record snowfalls, and 11 feet of snow. That's, you know, 135 inches of snow. And some areas outside of Anchorage got upwards of 200 inches. Rick Ulrich got some of these, well, I'll just say it bluntly. He stole some of these photos from me from the Anchorage newspaper. So this might cause you to ask, well, if Anchorage is getting all this snow, where's your global warming now, buddy? Well, this is the difference between weather versus climate. So the weather is essentially the thing that causes this. And it's kind of two somewhat kind of annual trends that kind of conspire together to bring this kind of massive snow to Anchorage. One of them is called La Niña. So what you see here is a map of the globe, North and South America, and you see the Pacific Ocean. Blue indicates cool water. So what's going on is that in a La Niña, there is cool water along the equator in the Pacific. And what this does is that it pushes the jet stream and the colder temperatures northward. And it causes more storms in the Pacific Northwest and drier weather in the Southwest and the South. Okay, so we've got the jet stream north, colder air north. Now, we combine this with something called the Arctic Oscillation. And the Arctic Oscillation is this oscillation between high and low pressure in the Arctic region versus the mid-latitude regions. And in this particular phase of the Arctic Oscillation, there's a persistent high pressure in mid-latitudes, i.e. where we are. And what that does is it drives the ocean storms further north. It also creates this whirlpool effect around the pole that kind of traps the cold air around the pole. So you put these two things together, this accentuates La Niña, and what you get are snow-filled storms heading right for Alaska. So this essentially are two things, the La Niña and the Arctic, and this positive phase of the Arctic oscillation conspire together to give us a relatively warm winter, but to give Alaska and Anchorage a relatively cold and very snowy winter. Now, this is a short-term effect. Climate has to do with long-term effects, and climate has to do with global scales. Okay, so weather is usually local and short-term, although short-term could be on the scale of months, whereas climate is larger scale and longer-term. So that's an important difference between climate and weather. So this then shows the average global temperature. This little chart here shows temperature on this scale and time on this scale in years. We have 1880 here, the year 2000 here. And this shows the average global temperature over the entire globe in each of these years. And you can notice, you know, from year to year, there's quite a bit of variation, but that there is this overall trend and an overall increasing, especially after about 1980. So the scale here, this is degrees Celsius. As a benchmark, 14 degrees Celsius is about 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And 1 degree change in Celsius, which is about from, say, this 13.8 to about the 14.8, is a little under 2 degrees change in Fahrenheit. This gets to be pretty big stuff. The interesting thing is that when you look at the trends, especially over the last 20 years, the 1980s were the warmest decade up to that point. Each year in the 1990s was warmer than the average temperature in the 1980s. Each year since 2000 has been warmer than the average temperature in the 1990s. So for each succeeding decade since the 80s, any average temperature in a particular year has been warmer than the average temperature of the previous decade. So there is certainly a warming trend. Now, another interesting thing is that people might say, okay, you know, what are causes of this? And one of the things they might say was, well, maybe there's slight variations in what our sun is doing. You know, maybe the sun is slightly warmer. Well, it turns out that no. Back in 2007 and 2008, there was a minimum, and which only has to do with solar minimum, does not have to do necessarily with the amount of energy that the sun is putting out, but rather it has to do with number of sunspots, number of solar storms, that sort of thing. However, coincident with that was, however, actually a slight decrease in solar energy during the time of about 2007 and 2008. But still, you can see that the average global temperature is still increasing. Okay. So it's not that we're getting more energy from the sun that's causing this increase. All right. So there is one of the primary pieces of evidence of climate change and, as people have talked about in the past, global warming. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about some of the evidence and effects. One of the prime effects of climate change is greater extremes in our weather. More tornadoes, stronger hurricanes, more hurricanes, you know, stronger storms, and it includes stronger snowstorms and stronger rainstorms, more drought, etc. Essentially, you know, one can somewhat say that one can categorize it in terms of more extreme weather. Now, it's important not to underestimate extreme weather and the effect that extreme weather has on us, because extreme weather certainly has an impact on property, it has an impact on economy, and it also has an impact on lives. In fact, in 2011, 1,000 lives were lost in the United States due to extreme weather, which is twice the average of what's usually lost during a year to extreme weather. So extreme weather certainly has an impact in many regards. Here are some of the other influences. Certainly there's receding glaciers. This is something that is probably well known. Here is the Muir Glacier in Alaska. This is about 100 miles northwest of Juneau. You can see in 1891, there was the glacier. In 2008, 2005, no more glacier. It's gone. Another effect is that the Arctic, the polar ice cap in the Arctic Ocean. You may be able to see there's a very squiggly line here, which is the median extent of the ice in late summer. And this median extent is taken from 1979 to 2000. That's kind of taken as median. And then since then, we measure it relative to that median. And so you can see that it's shrinking. One of the important things is that all of the old ice, because sometimes, of course, there would be ice that would persist from one season to another. But at this point, all of the oldest and the thickest ice in the Arctic Ocean has now disappeared. And some of the biological effects is actually on the polar bears. So the polar bear feeding season is that the polar bears hunt the seals. Where are the seals? They're in the ocean. How do the polar bears get to the ocean? On the ice. When the ice shrinks, the polar bears can't get out to the ocean. So that means the feeding season for the polar bears decreases. That means the polar bears become endangered. And let's see, the U.S. Geological Survey predicts that 2/3 of the world's polar bears will disappear by the year 2050 due to essentially the shrinkage and the earlier recession of the ice in the Arctic Ocean. All right, and another effect is shrinking lakes. This is the lake whose name I can't pronounce. This is the lake in Florida. This is a comparison of its extent versus 2007, and essentially it is shrinking due to drought, agriculture, and residential use. So the 2007 image shows that it is about 9 feet below its average depth. And if the levels in lakes are going to shrink, then the sea level will also rise. Now, all you guys who are colorblind, go ahead and ask the lady next to you where the red is. It's along the coast, and ask her how far inland it goes. So this is a prediction of sea level rise to 1 meter, and the effect that a sea level rise of 1 meter would have on the eastern seaboard. Now, 1 meter is about to there, okay? And you can see it pretty well inundates, you know, a lot of the coastal areas and a number of the rivers as well. Now, the one thing that's interesting with making the models is sort of trying to figure out what the time scale is for this 1 meter sea rise. And I looked at a bunch of different sources, and the models certainly vary. It can be anywhere from, you know, 2075 to early in the next century. But there are others who do say that by 2050, we might have a sea level rise of about a foot. Now, let's think for a minute about what's causing the sea level to rise. Well, there could be the obvious one. The ice is melting. Now, you have to think about which ice is melting that's important. The ice melting at the Arctic Ocean, that doesn't count because that's already in the ocean. The ice that's melting in Greenland and in the Antarctic, that melting ice counts, okay? Because it's not in the ocean right now. When it melts, it puts water into the ocean. So that's one cause of the rising sea level, melting land glaciers. The other cause is the warming itself, because warmer water expands. So because the warmer water expands, that causes a rise in the sea level, and combine that with the melting of the land-based glaciers. And those are two of the things that cause the sea level to rise. All right, other biological effects. There are these white park pines that live high up in the mountains, and this map where the little black splotches indicate where they have been prevalent and where they currently are prevalent. You can see that their habitat is decreasing. And what's killing them are these mountain pine beetles. So first of all, what the trees do is, because of their canopy, one of the things they do is they preserve the snowfall in those upper elevations. The snow lasts longer. That means it feeds the streams longer. All right? So what's happening is these mountain pine beetles, because of the warmer weather, are able to infest these trees at these high elevations, and they kill off these trees. And of course, by killing off these trees, that means there's less shade, and therefore the snow doesn't last as long as these high elevations, and it has almost literally, or maybe not so literally, there's the lack of the trickle-down effect. Yeah, that's it. And of course, the trees also feed the bears that live at that elevation. Okay, so the warming temperatures have allowed these mountain pine beetles to infest these trees that otherwise they couldn't infest because it was too cold for them up there. All right, so what exactly is causing all this? Well, it essentially is heat-trapping gases, otherwise known as greenhouse gases, and the most well-known of these is carbon dioxide. This is a long-term history of the amount of carbon dioxide that has been in our atmosphere. So this is 400,000 years ago. So these are very long-term trends, and you can see that there is this kind of interesting oscillation. And what this oscillation is actually caused by are slight variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun and slight variations in the wobble of the Earth. These slight variations in the orbit and in the Earth and in the tilt of the Earth do cause slight differences in the amount of solar energy that we get. And that slight difference in amount of solar energy causes things like ice ages. And when we have an ice age, what happens is that the biological activity on the Earth decreases. And when that biological activity on the Earth decreases, the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere decreases. And then when we get a warming, then of course the biomass returns and the carbon dioxide increases again. So there's this very natural oscillation that has occurred that's been due to very natural causes. But you can see that since 1950, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has almost literally skyrocketed. So what's behind this is essentially the carbon cycle. So the carbon cycle essentially starts with, you know, some amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and sunlight, which essentially produces photosynthesis in the plants. That essentially absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And from the plants, you know, it goes into animals. Animals, it goes into other animals. It goes into the ground. And if it goes into the ground, both from animal waste and the animals themselves dying and decaying, ultimately it can become fossil fuel. The carbon dioxide also can get absorbed by the ocean. So there's this rather natural cycle that occurs, except there's this one other part that we have introduced. That is, we take these fossil fuels, we burn them, and we release the carbon dioxide. So we have here a very natural balance that we have come in and, through probably starting at the Industrial Revolution, have essentially disrupted. So in a sense, it's hard to say this, but we have upset this natural balance. So that leads us to our first punchline, which is, this is, everybody remember The Far Side? Okay. I have this in one of the drawers in my office. I have a folder full of my all-time favorite Far Side cartoons. And I cannot get through the whole thing without just collapsing on the floor in laughter, because they are my all-time favorites. And this one is the three scientists, and you can tell they're looking in a mirror, and you can tell they're actually supposed to be studying primates. And one of them turns to the other and says, "For crying out loud, gentlemen, that's us! Someone installed the one-way mirror in backwards." And essentially, you know, when we look at these plots, what we see is essentially us. It is us, and how is it us? It's us through this. It is us through our transportation. It's us through our burning of the fossil fuels. And it's us through deforestation. Because deforestation takes one of these sinks, or one of the things that's going to absorb carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and it actually releases the carbon dioxide that is in the plant. And scientists who study this, there's, of course, you know, the scientists who study this are able to say, you know, with a greater than 90% certainty that, that yes, it is human causes, it's human-caused increases in greenhouse gases that is one of the primary causes for climate change. So it is us through these factors, and now we finally come down to what can we do about it? Well, this is very interesting because this is a multifaceted question, and there's many ways on which to ask this question, and there's many ways in which to answer this question. First of all, we can answer it on a very personal and individual level. So what are some things that we can do? Well, we can reduce, reuse, recycle. One of the things that's interesting in far as reducing is to not only think in terms of reducing our energy use, but reducing our overall consumption. Because if you think about material things take energy to produce, and of course material things take energy to transport. We can do things like conduct energy audits of our homes, buy Energy Star appliances, and we can do things like, you know, buying fresh, buying local, which of course also helps the local economy. So these are all things that we can do as individuals. Other things that we can do is we think about our energy consumption. We can think about where the energy comes from. Now, every year, BG&E, our beloved primary energy provider, tells you exactly how they produce the energy. They tell you this every year, and it's, you know, 46% of the energy that BG&E produces is from coal, 33% is from nuclear, and 11% is from natural gas, and then the rest are from renewable and essentially a system mix. We don't have too much hydroelectric in this area, so predominantly the energy that BG&E produces is from coal and nuclear power. But of course, we can also seek alternative energy sources. Since we do live in an energy choice state, we can actually investigate other energy-producing companies and actually contract with them. And, of course, you can produce your own energy by putting your own solar panels on your house. And if you do this on a bright enough sunny day, you can actually watch your electric meter run backwards because you can be producing more energy. You can actually be producing an excess of energy. So all of these are well and good. And these are, you know, all things that we as individuals can be doing, and to some degree what we as communities can be doing.